Hebrews 4:14-5:10. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Every high priest is selected from among the people and is appointed to represent the people in matters related to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He is able to deal gently with those who are ignorant and are going astray, since he himself is subject to weakness. This is why he has to offer sacrifices for his own sins, as well as for the sins of the people. And no one takes this honor on himself, but he receives it when called by God, just as Aaron was. In the same way, Christ did not take on himself the glory of becoming a high priest, but God said to him, "You are my son. Today I have become your father." And he says in another place, "You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek." During the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with fervent cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. Son though he was, he learned obedience from what he suffered. And once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him, and was designated by God to be the high priest in the order of Melchizedek.
Thank you, Laurel. I'm so glad that I've had a number of weeks to prepare for this particular passage. As you know, a couple weeks ago, I was all prepared and ready to roll, but a rogue piece of chicken on Saturday lunch took me out on that particular Sunday, and you're probably glad for it, as I was. And so I've been sitting on this text and this message for a good time. And on this Sunday of the King, we get to take a good look at the King who walked on earth. Because what a King he is. Because the one that we follow, even through baptism, this King is one we are invited to put our hope into, to find certainty in this King. It's called faith. As the book of Hebrews does say later on, as we get to it, it defines faith this way: being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. Faith is difficult. We have sung praises to a King we do not see. We believe in the promises of the King, which is not yet all realized. We put our faith in one who declares great things, and yet we find ourselves in the context of struggle and difficulty. And the challenge for us, as it was for those who first received this message from this preacher of Hebrews who somehow crafted it and has been delivered to us. Thank you, Holy Spirit. Is a challenge to believe. For today is the day. You know, when I think about faith, I think of a young child that's at school, maybe kindergarten. Mom drops her off. And you know, that child never really worries about being picked up. She knows that she's probably going to come home and find food, her toys, and a warm bed. And she never fears, for mom is always there. Come long lineups, come big task lists, but she never fears. That may change, of course. But when you think of faith of a child, what is the opposite of faith? It is fear. And here in this sermon to these Christians who, these Jewish Christians who were a small community, the preacher was tackling their anxiousness. It was dangerous to become a Christian. So much changed when you flip from one belief system to a new one. There was economic repercussions. There were familial repercussions. You were marginalized. You dug yourself deep into the catacombs. You were the rejected ones. And you could imagine that for so many of these, they were beginning to think, is this good? Is this worth it? Is God really going to make this happen? And the concern of the preacher is that these children of God would shrink back. He uses those words later on in the sermon. They were ones who once were full of life and hope, but because of fear, began to shrink back. Their faith, in fact, was being replaced by fear. I don't think it's difficult for us to relate to that. We live in an age where people have diagnosed, you know, so many people with a general anxiety disorder. We're an anxious people, an anxious culture. So many of us live in fear, and I would suggest that so many of us live in fear. That so many of us, our faith has shrunk. And we live in the context of fear and uncertainty. The preacher's goal, however, is to challenge us. He says, I've got better things in mind for you. He says this, we are convinced of better things for you. We want each of you to show diligence to the very end so that what you hope for may be fully realized. We do not want you to become lazy, because sometimes that's what uncertainty and fear does. It makes us undiligent and therefore lazy, and we begin to have this avoidance towards God. And we begin to give up. We don't maybe give up the form of the faith in terms of what we might think in terms of belief, but in our hearts, we are not pressing in. We're not going deeper. We're not really walking with Jesus. I've got better things for you. We don't want you to become lazy, but to imitate those who through faith and patience inherit what is promised. So he's calling the people. He's calling us to be patient, to be faithful, and to move forward despite whatever place you may be at right now that causes you to shrink back. He puts a warning out there. It's an important warning. Because if we shrink back, and this goes back to chapter 4, and I'm building up to the text here, but it's important. He has a very big concern that the people he's writing to may not enjoy the Sabbath rest that God is promising them. Sabbath rest, not being exactly life after death, the eternity with God, even though we can talk about what that exactly means. But it's about missing out on the reality of being fully in participation with God and living in the joy of his presence for you now. That you're going to shrink back from enjoying all that God has for you because you are shrinking back. And he tells the story. He says, remember that time when Israel... Remember Israel when after God had liberated them from Egypt, after he had guided them through the Red Sea and brought them to Mount Sinai and where he gave them his word in a new way of life, and even though Israel was showing a little bit of trouble and uncertainty, nevertheless, God was faithful to them, and he took them all the way towards the promised land to a place called Kadesh Barnea. And at Kadesh Barnea, he said, now send 12 people out, 12 spies to check out the land. This is going to be so exciting. Go check it out and then report back and encourage the people to step into faith. Do you remember the story? The 12 came back carrying loads of promising good. But 10 of the 12 were shrunk by fear. We're grasshoppers. They're giants. We have no walls. They have big walls. And the 10 of those 12 set fear rampant in the camp. And where did they want to go? Back to Egypt. And there's the promised land. God is leading you with fire and cloud and with manna. He's feeding you. He's there for you. And yet, all of that meant nothing to them because their fear took them out. And for 40 years, so God said, wow. So for 40 years, they walk in the desert until that generation of fear died and a new generation of hope was born. And what's amazing is this. The very fear of that community even stopped God from moving forward. God lived in the wilderness for 40 years. The mission of God shrunk, so to speak. The people's faith kept Israel from enjoying the Sabbath rest. And so he's saying to you, today's the day. You people in Cloverdale, don't shrink back from all that God is calling you to do. Now, there's this path of perishing that he describes, and it's worth me pointing this out very quickly, but I know Brian and I are going to probably talk a little bit more about this in days to come. But in the Hebrew text, as this author is beginning to build it up, he says, I want you to notice something. What happened in Israel at Kadesh Barnea is a number of things. And you can and just look at that particular text that's before you. I hope you can read it. It's chapter 3. And there's four words out there that I want to highlight. The top one is rebelled, sinned, disobeyed, and unbelief. Fundamentally, if you start from the bottom, the last word, their rebellion started with a lack of trust in God. They disbelieved God. Their disbelief led them to disobey. And in their disobedience, they sinned. And their sinning became outright rebellion to God. Why? Because they didn't trust God. There's this great little picture here. You can just sort of see a tree there. I like this image. But when you look at your life and you see the sin in your life, perhaps, I think it's true. They can trace it back to the point of your disbelief in God. The reason you sin is because you think there's a better way. The alternative is to believe, to obey, to do good works or be righteous because you're following God's ways. And that's called what? Faithfulness. It's an important point as we move forward here, because as this community of faith is being challenged by this preacher, he wants them to go in a new direction that is difficult, that will cost much. It won't be easy. And even for us, who people of faith, and it's so great to have this this baptism today, because Seth, along with all of us who have been baptized, we chose a way of life that is not easy. Jesus has invited us into a life of what? Suffering as he has suffered. Growing as he has grown. And so this author is saying, believe. Have faith. And so now he begins to say, here's what you need. And already through this book, and now chapter 5 is as a key turning point. And this will sound more like teaching than preaching perhaps today, because it's sort of key to get this sort of straight, because it's sort of the key point that he makes and out of which he spends the next 4 to 5 chapters building upon. So it's so good that you're here. All the rest of our preaching on Hebrews sort of hinges back to this and expands it. And so if you're saying, oh, Jim, you moved too fast through some of this material, guess what? We're going to pick up these themes in significant ways to come. But the thing that this preacher now introduces is the idea, the concept, a Hebrew concept that Jesus is the high priest. Now, that's common to us. We sing songs about this. But for these Hebrew Christians, it's like, what? He's the high priest? Already 3 times. In 2 verse 17, he introduces Jesus as the high priest. He sort of hints at this. In 3 verse 1, and then in 4 verse 14 that we also read today, 3 times he's mentioned him as high priest, and now he sort of says, okay, here's what I mean by this. And for these first century Christians, it's like, and particularly Jewish ones, it's like the high priest, this is offbeat, this is out of step, this doesn't really feel congruent, because the high priest in Israel was the one selected by people to be, he was the most dignified and most honored person in society on the very day that he became one. He would be in the center of the parade. He'd be like the queen or king going down the street. Jesus, wow, he was the one crucified. Now to describe him as high priest, stunning. But yet it's so critical, because to understand Jesus the high priest will have fundamental impact on how you believe and what you believe about Jesus and what it means for you each and every day of your Christian life. Because if you don't get Jesus as high priest, as you will see, it's very hard to put your faith in Jesus. And so he begins to unpack. And so let me faith is believing that Jesus is your high priest. And as we, let me just quickly go through this because I can't take a lot of time, but I do want to highlight one big thing about who Jesus is as high priest. It's a number of things, and we'll unpack this more. But what we're going to zero in on today is Jesus is the faithful one. He's the faithful high priest. So chapter 5, verses 1 through 10 can be divided in two nice chunks. The first chunk describes the typical high priest that everybody would know from the Old Testament if you were a Jew, a Hebrew person. And you would think of the high priest who had the Urim and Thummim and all that kind of stuff on, who would walk into the temple and do what needs to be done. And verses 5 to 10 is what I would describe as the atypical high priest, Jesus. Somebody not so fancy. Though I couldn't find pictures that were less handsome than that. Did you notice that when you look for pictures of Jesus, the humanity of Jesus, it's like Tom Brady, you know? Most often. So we're going to take a look at these two chunks. First chunk very quickly. So what is a typical high priest? One is this, because the contrast is so important. The typical high priest was appointed out of the line of Aaron. And so to be a high priest in Israel, you had to be born in a particular tribe, the Levites, whose father was Aaron. And, you know, if you felt like you were a high priest, but you were from the line of, you know, Manasseh, that, you can't get the job. Why? Because you're not from the right family, right? And the selection process, we don't need to go in there, but even through the selection process, it even says God honored that person and appointed them. So it was even a godly ordination of that one person who would do the job. Secondly, he was selected from humans for the sake of humans. So the high priest was not some ghost. It wasn't some animal. It was somebody who was human for the sake of humans. Three, the task, he offers gifts and sacrifices once a year to atone for the sins of humanity. I'm maybe stretching it. But wasn't the business of Israel for the sake of the world, not just Israel? So notice my small point there. So his job was every year, a significant task. All of the sins of the people were accumulated. And this act of the priest before God cleaned them up. And four, his job was to represent humanity in matters relating to God. That was his number one task. That's your typical high priest. That was his job. So let's take, but here's a highlight before we move on to the other one. The author highlights something particular about the typical high priest, and that is his humanity. He is able to deal gently with those who are ignorant and are going astray, since he himself is subject to weakness. The weakness of what? Being human in a broken world. And this is why he has to offer. So when he makes his offering, what does he have to do first? Before he does it for the sake of the people, he has to first get himself cleaned up. So he first does an offering for himself, gets cleaned up, and then being clean, consecrated, he is able now to do the rest of the job. Why? Because he's human and he's broken and he needs to do this part. And it's because of that, and what the author is highlighting, he's saying, this high priest who is so honored, is it really able to be nice to you? Because, you know, he fundamentally knows that he's human too. And now he's serving you because he knows that you're weak too. And by his merciful and compassionate way of service, he is able to do good work. I highlight that because it's key when we talk about the atypical one. So the atypical, offbeat high priest. How offbeat is he? Well, one, he's appointed out of the line of Melchizedek instead of the line of Aaron. Jesus, what is he doing being the high priest? He's not from the line of Aaron. He's from the line of, well, there is no line. There's no Israelite tribe called the Melchizedekians, thank goodness. What is this author doing? He's doing something really radical, and it's like, mind-blowing to, what are you doing? Well, we're going to talk about that in chapter 6 and 7. The point is, right from the outset, it's an off-step. Jesus is a different kind of high priest that comes from a different line, which we'll learn more about later. And it's a big point, though, because he mentions it twice in this text. So Jesus already is somebody who's not what you think. And God has appointed somebody new for the sake of a new way. Okay. All right. Second, he is selected from humans for the sake of humans, but chapter 4, which we read, he was without sin. Oh. Now, let me warn you today. We may dare some theological frameworks that you make be comfortable in. And I can't help but follow this text and make you uncomfortable. Because we are dealing with who Jesus is and how he became high priest. And it means we are going to go deep into him as a human. And it's important for us because if we are to follow him, we are not able to follow a God. We can only follow what? A human. Who lived the true, genuine, human life that God calls us to live. If our faith is shaped by being like Jesus, who is God, guess what? You will fail. Because you're not God. And so the author, for the sake of their understanding of what it means to be Christian, he's saying, see Jesus, he's human, but he's uniquely human. In fact, more human than you. Because a human that sins is an abnormal human the way God created it. Living life without the power of God in one's life, the renewal of God, is to be unhuman. The image bearers of God. Jesus came, was a human, but he lived without sin. As a human. I quoted that text already. 4 verse 15. Get my little thing to work here. So there you see that text. An atypical high priest on two accounts now, and now a third. And now, let's get a little deeper here. And I just wanted to tell you that I've been profoundly impacted by working through this message. It's changing the way I'm thinking. Third, Jesus presented offerings, just like a typical high priest. But unlike the typical high priest, who did it once a year, Jesus offered a life of fervent prayers and tears. If I was to ask you what offering Jesus made, what would be your answer? Well, Jesus offered his life on the cross. He gave his life for the sake of all of us. That would be a good answer. We answer it that way so often. But this author is not answering it exactly the same way. He's saying, well, read this verse. The extent of Christ's offering is during the days of Jesus' life on earth. During the days of Jesus. So we're talking what? Incarnation. We are talking a 12-year-old who's sitting in the temple with all these authorities and thinking and talking with them. We're talking about all that in between incarnation to then, when he was growing up as a kid, which we don't know too much about. We're talking about the time when he stepped into We're talking about, Jesus' entrance into ministry right up to the cross. And this author is suggesting that the whole of that span of life was an offering of Jesus. Described in this way, filled with petitions, fervently crying, and with tears. Now, so often we think of the time at Golgotha or Gethsemane, the garden where he has this great struggle. But this author, unlike any other author in the New Testament, is not described this way, though it's not hard to imagine that the whole life of Jesus was one of painful, prayerful engagement with life and what it meant to be faithful in the context of a world that wouldn't receive him. I think there's something stunning about that. I mean, why would Jesus pray so fervently and so painfully if he was God? Didn't he know everything would be okay? Didn't he know that, hey, tomorrow I'm going to be seeing that lady that, needs a bit of healing, and that's how that's going to happen, and now this is going to happen, and what's my schedule? Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm going to be arrested then, and man, I can't wait till this gets over. Did Jesus live that way? Did Jesus, because he was divine, sat in school thinking, oh, I already know this stuff. Oh, my goodness, I've got to endure this. Did Jesus have to learn? Did Jesus have to grow? Did Jesus have to make decisions all along the way about what was faithfulness and what was rebellion? Was that experience difficult for Jesus? So the text says, yes. He can empathize with us. Why? Because he knows exactly what it's like to be a person who seeks God but finds it very difficult to follow God. Because everything about following God meant what? More pain, more hurt, more struggle. You can imagine as this Christian community listens to this, they're like, I know you're pushing me. I know you're asking me to step into things more difficult and more challenging. I'm not sure, God, can you? And so he's pointing out Jesus, the one who
Let me put it this way, a radical thought. One who needed to be saved. Like you, Jesus needed to be saved. Okay. I tested this one with Monica and she said, take it out. I tested it with the boys and they're okay. But look at this text. Let's go back to that text for a minute. What is it? I underline it and said, he prayed to the one who could save him from death. Jesus, like you, needed to be saved. He's the one who needed to depend on the power of God to make good what God promised to him. Now, this gets into some Christological realities. Did Jesus know that he was God while he was a human? Well, if you look at Philippians, it said that Jesus emptied himself of all that was divine in order to be what? Human. It seems, and I'm not a great theologian, but there is some sense that Jesus walked on earth not fully realizing immediately that he was divine. And only through his walk of obedience does he become fully aware of who he is. Even to the point that when he was crucified, he wasn't sure until he was raised from the dead and ascended into heaven, as we will find out. Now, if you have issues with that, just talk to Brian. Fourth, Jesus the high priest represents humans in matters pertaining to God, just like a high priest, but he did so perfectly. So if we're uncomfortable at point three, let me make you a little bit more uncomfortable now. Jesus needed to learn obedience. It wasn't automatic. Jesus' obedience wasn't automatic. He needed to learn to obey. And this is what the text said. Right? I mean, right there. Son, though he was. Divine, though he was. Son of God, though he was. Comma. Jesus learned obedience from what? He suffered. And once made perfect. Just a minute. He wasn't perfect. Jesus, when he was born, he wasn't perfect. Yeah, no, he dirtied his diapers. He cried in the middle of the night. He built things with his dad that broke. Sometimes he had to do miracles twice to make it stick. He prayed not just to be a model of prayer to his disciples, but because he needed to pray. How uncomfortable are you now? And once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him. If Jesus did not learn obedience through his suffering, we would not be saved. Jesus needed to be a new Adam to replace the old Adam. He needed, as a human, to do what humans were called to do but couldn't do. And so he became human in order to do, but only belief would accomplish. A And so Jesus grew into obedience. Now, when did this happen, really? Oh, my goodness, I got to hurry up. I'm almost done. When was Jesus the high priest? When he was born? When he was crucified? No. When he ascended into heaven. That's when God said, good. And raised him up to the right hand of the Father, to himself. Jesus was the faithful one. Jesus could have sinned, but he chose not to. He chose to obey. And Jesus is a faithful priest, it says. He was faithful to the one who appointed him. Chapter 3, 6, Christ is faithful as a son over God's house. He proved faithful. In fact, there's this text in Hebrews 10, 9, 10, where it says, it's not these old offerings I bring. And Jesus says, and it's a great, beautiful picture of Jesus coming before the Father in the ascension and says, here I am. I have come to do what? Your will. And I have done it. I am faithful. And as a result, by that will, by his decisions, by his way of life, God raised him up from the grave, and we have been made holy through the sacrifice of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. Because of his life, because of his obedience, because of what he learned, he makes us new. So what does that mean for us as that text was read? I guess a real question for you, as it was for those that heard this sermon the first time and read it, what is your Kadesh? Where are you right now where you are struggling to decide whether to follow God or not? Are you ready to go in the direction that God is calling you to? Do you trust him? I mean, I was at this conference this week and I came ambivalent and uncertain and ready to get my money back before I even arrived. It was a time of listening to God and building friendships with other guys and learning about the deeper spiritual life and spiritual Christian formation and all these things. And I'm like, But today was the day. That's what I heard. Jim, do you want to grow? Do you want more of what God is? Are you willing to go down this path? Fear. Faith. You are all at a Kadesh. And will you believe that God is able, through his son, Jesus Christ, give you the capacity to live for him? That you can trust in the Spirit just as Jesus trusted in the Spirit. And believe in God and his faithfulness because Jesus believed in his faithfulness. And that in Jesus is declared to all of us that living God's way can happen for you. A more iconic picture of Jesus. Our host, our priest, who serves you, who understands you, and invites you into a life of following him in faith, not fear. So let us approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need.